The horse did?
Olympic. Disability education presentation.
Is that a unanimous vote?
I'm sorry?
Is that a unanimous vote?
We didn't vote on that.
We didn't vote on that?
I didn't think so.
That was direction.
It was in the form of a motion.
This part was just intended to be direction.
Request for the staff to come back.
You wanted that as your proposed direction, right?
Mine was proposed direction.
Right.
That's what the intent, and it seems like it was received that way.
I gotta say, Gail, you're comfortable with?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wordiness.
Okay.
Took me a long time to get it down to one page.
I'm sorry, but I couldn't let it go.
I appreciate the bold.
Just for me.
Terry's a bold guy.
Yeah, right.
We're going to now go on to agenda item number 10. It's an overview of the disability retirement process. You have the presentation in your materials, as well as it will be on the overhead. Today we have Leilani Green here from the disability department. She's a specialist. She's a disability specialist. Unfortunately, Charisse Jimenez is out ill and cannot attend, but Susan Hastings is here, who is our disability attorney, Sarah's disability attorney, and she's decided to sit on in, and if you have any questions, assist in the presentation. So, going to slide number 2, how is Sarah normally receive initial contact on a disability application? I mean, it normally come in a couple of different ways. The member can contact Sarah directly via phone. They may have a walk-in, or the employer could file an application for the member. During this process, the disability process is fully explained to the member. The disability packet, if it's a phone call, is mailed out to the member, so they have the entire packet of information. And then counseling appointments are set up to go through what the disability process is for the member. And the department spends a lot of time on applications on slide number 3. They hand out and have numerous contact with members that are seeking information on a disability. Only a actually small percentage of disabilities actually go to as far as being accepted or submitted into the system. Employee submitted applications, normally about 40% of them are accepted, meaning enough information was provided. When the employer does it, it's 80% of those are rejected. A lot of times the member does not go along with it. The employer doesn't have the information to file or complete the application. So a lot of time is spent for the number of applications that actually come in. It's as far as working with members, it's really a high touch point process that they go through, and lots of communication and meetings through the process. When the staff meets with the applicant, they're going to go through like a basic benefit estimate. They're going to calculate purchases if the individual needs to purchase time to become eligible for the disability. They're going to explain our disability standards. I know you've all sat through when we start talking about Tier 3 and substantial gainful employment and safety in Tier 1, where we talk about usual and customary or your normal job duties. They'll spend quite a bit of time there. They also counsel the applicant throughout the process, as well as if they're eligible for a service retirement, where we'll notice where we've had safety individuals coming in, they're also eligible to take a service retirement. will coach them or help them through the service retirement while their disability retirement is in process. The service retirement is a quicker process to go through than the disability process. As well as they communicate with the employer and other groups such as the ADA coordinator, return to work coordinator, and work comp. The application shall be made, and we have four different bullet points, and this is exactly out of the law book. The application shall be made while the member is in service within four months after discontinuance of service, or within 4 months after the expiration of any period which a presumption is extended beyond the discontinuance in service, or while from the date of discontinuance of service to the time of the application, the applicant is continuously physically and mentally incapacitated to perform his job duties. Eligibility for a disability, for a service-connected disability, all tiers are eligible for a service-connected disability at any time. The non-service-connected disability is a little different. For Tier 1 safety and PEPRA safety, they must have completed 5 years of retirement service credit, and for Tier 3 and PEPRA, they must have completed 10 years of retirement service credit. Now, on slide number 7, the member must be permanently incapacitated from performance of duty. The service connected, and now this is specific to the first group, the Tier 1, the safety, and the PEPRA. They have to be unable to do their usual and customary duties, and the service-connected disability arose out of their job performance or doing their job course of employment, where the non-service has the same usual and customary duties of the current position, but it did not come out of their employment. The disability benefit for that group of members, the Tier 1 safety and PEPRA safety, for a service-connected disability, it's 50% of the highest final 12-month salary, and a portion of that, up to the 50% of the salary, is non-taxable to the member. If the service retirement is greater, the service retirement will be calculated and awarded to them, and a portion of that would be non-taxable.
So just so I'm clear, Tim.
Yeah.
I go on a service-connected disability. I'm getting $5,000 a month. I'm getting $10,000 a month. $5,000 of it is tax free.
Your base salary is $120,000 a year, $10,000 a month.
Yes.
And you have enough service, have enough service to get a $6,000 a month benefit.
Yes.
The service connected portion is 50% of the salary, so that would be $5,000 would be tax free or non-taxable, and that additional $1,000 that is earned because of the service retirement being better would be taxable.
Okay, I got it.
And then for a non-service, that was service connected, is 50%. Non-service connected, it's one-third of the highest 12-month final average salary. The time period for the safety C and the PEPRA is a 36-month period rather than 12 months. For Tier 3 and PEPRA, the requirements, as far as it being related to your, during your course of employment, or not for non-service. The difference with Tier 3, and I know we've been through it numerous times on applications we've looked at, is substantial gainful employment. And if we turn to slide 10, substantial gainful employment, this is something that's unique to Contra Costa County. It was adopted in 1981. 91. I'm getting ahead of myself. 91, but it's substantial gainful employment is the permanent inability to work is determined by an examination of many specific factors such as age, experience, training, education, and appropriate jobs available. And the target is 50% of what they would make in as their disability benefit, or if self-employed, $300. This is the standard where you could have been, you know, say, an IT technician. And under Tier 3, you have other talents that you could do, and we'll have a vocational expert go through jobs within a 100-mile range of the individual's home and look for other forms of employment that that individual could fulfill. For service-connected and non-service-connected disability for Tier 3, and PEPR's a little different than what we had on the other tiers, the disability is 40% of the highest final 36-month salary. Earlier, I mentioned that we had presumptions that came up for safety. Safety has four different presumptions. The first one is a heart presumption. The second is cancer. Then there's blood-borne infectious diseases, and then biochemical substance. And in these cases, safety members are relieved of the burden of proving their illness arose out of and in the course of employment when a presumption applies. Permanent incapacity must still be proven with medical evidence, and the presumptions are rebuttable. The initial file review, that takes place when the application is filed by the member. The department will send a confirmation letter is sent to the member, as well as all of the applicable departments, letting them know that an application was received and accepted. The member is placed, as you saw on our agenda earlier today, the member is placed on the consent items list for the next board meeting. A confidential disability case file is established for those records and are actually sectioned off from the rest of SACERA records. And then all of the records are reviewed to determine additional information that may be needed to process the application. A lot of times when the applications come in, they may come in just with, you say, with one medical notification. It may be a page or a couple of pages. These files can grow into thousands of pages of medical records, which may have to go to our medical advisor. If the application is filed by the department, we'll go through the same process as that it's reviewed for eligibility. The member is notified that the department filed the application on the member's behalf. If the member joins the filing, it then reverts to a member-filed application at that point in time. If the member doesn't join the filing, the burden of proof falls on the employer, and it is rare for the employer to have the medical information to move forward. It's very unusual. And then now to prepare the case file to process the application and records that are requested, medical records. So earlier today, we talked a little about the workers' compensation file. That is requested. Medical records, all of the medical records that we can get are requested. Occupational health records are requested as needed. And then on the employment side, we're going to get the job description, essential job duties. We're going to request the information on accommodations. Can the individual be accommodated in their department? And then there's always other miscellaneous records that come up. Once we have all of the information, it is then submitted to the medical advisor. The medical advisor receives the information. Normally, I'm going to say could be a lot of paper that is sent to them. Recently, we're now moving, getting a lot of information in electronic format on CDs and so forth. The medical records all have to be itemized chronologically by the physician. Non-medical records are itemized by source. And then it is sent to the medical advisor. when the medical advisor assesses the information, you know, they'll make, or he will make, one of the following recommendations. One is to grant the application as it is filed. He has received insufficient medical evidence to make a recommendation. Then the recommendation would be grant a non-service connected disability when the applicant filed for a service connected disability. Or, and we've seen this come up a couple of times, the applicant is disabled, but they need to do the vocational assessment, and that would be under our substantial gainful employment population. If the medical advisor recommends, recommendation is to grant, the applicant, all the departments, you know, related departments are notified, and then it's placed on to the board, the next board agenda. If the medical advisor's opinion is there's insufficient medical evidence, the applicant and the related departments are notified, and the applicant is advised that they can file additional medical. Yes, sir.
Just off the top of your head, just a, if you can, or a guess at it as close as you can get, how many applications that are filed for service are recommended non-service? Do you know how many are changed? Just an idea. Is it 5%, 10% might be, or?
I think it's about 5%. Yeah. I've only seen one in my year and a half or so doing this. I've only seen the one
okay.
so far.
Yeah. Okay. Same here. It's probably the same. We're probably thinking of the same one that we've seen come up. And, you know,
it's kind of rare when that happens.
Yeah, we'll see, getting the vocational assessment more frequent than moving to non-service.
All right.
And I think we have seen where in some of the reports that are written, they'll come back and say they cannot see the service connection to what they're filing their service-connected disability under, and that would be a case of that.
Just out of curiosity, what would be a reason that they would go with non-service?
The person is disabled. However, it is unclear if it is a work-related incident. I think we've had some that have come up, maybe over respiratory, things like that. I'm sorry?
A cancer case.
A cancer case, okay. Yeah, where it could go either way. That member still could come back and say, okay, I'm going to take the non-service, but I want to proceed and move forward with a service option still.
Just ask a question. What training and background do the medical advisors have for being able to make job-related determinations?
The individuals that we have, that he's a vocational expert. He's a doctor, PhD, and his specialty is occupational placement, looking at I'm trying to think now. Just the disabilities or the restrictions upon the individual, and looking at what jobs are within the area that individual could fulfill. It may not be very clear, again, the job that recommended may not be very close at all to their current occupation. Under substantial gainful employment, it's making enough money in that role.
For tier three.
Tier three is substantial gainful employment, correct. And we're just talking about is if the member's notified of the recommendation and they do have the option, they can accept the non-service connected disability, and basically it would close the file, or they can accept the non-service connected pending determination of causation, which we just talked about. They can decline the non-service connected disability altogether, which we have had happen. And we've also had decline the non-service connected disability or retirement allowance and request a hearing. And we have had that happen for whatever reason. Even though, like I said, we're going to go to hearing, they don't want to take the non-service, even though they can take the non-service and then move to a service connected if it's approved. When we go out to hearing, that's the discovery process. A hearing is requested by the, you know, may be requested by the applicant. In the last year or so, the board has requested discovery in a few instances that we've come across. The staff sends all of the information to our the board's disability counsel, Susan Hastings, and her law firm. An independent medical evaluation may be completed in order to obtain current restrictions pertaining to the disability. On occasion, the information we have is dated, and we want to get more recent information. And then Tier 3 and PEPR members, kind of going back to Harvey's questions, will have restrictions set forth by the treating physician and IME evaluated by the vocational expert to determine if they're able to engage in any substantial gainful employment. And if any time during this process we feel we have enough information or evidence to support their disability, we will move it forward to the board without completing the hearing. Okay, then we're going to move to one you're familiar with, which is if the full discovery did not result in the evidence to recommend granting the application. This is when we'll go to the Department of Administrative Hearings, and we'll have the case heard by an administrative law judge. That hearing can be here. It could be at their offices in Oakland. They'll issue a report to the board within 30 days of the hearing with their recommendation, and it's placed on the board for action. And then after the hearing and it goes before the board has four options on the actions that it could take. And the first one is to approve and adopt the proposed findings and recommendations that from the hearing officer, or refer the matter back to the hearing officer for further proceedings, or require a transcript or summary of all testimony plus the evidence, and the board shall take the action it determines is warranted, or the board could hold a hearing before itself. Normally, this board has taken option number one or two. They will accept the recommendation as presented, or they'll refer it back for more information to the hearing officer. Now, we get down to the point of, after we go through that process, the case file is closed with no board action. The applicant does not request a hearing or submit additional evidence. It has not gone away. It's still, we carry it as an open item on our books because they have 6 months from the date of notice of the medical advisor to reopen, and after that point, a closing letter will be sent to close the item with the member.
Just a small question. Is that a certified letter?
You know, our policy does not say certified letter. Our practice has been certified letters, but going through the policy that is in your packet, it talks about first class postage.
Just seems like when you reach this point in the process, it's nice not to have them be able to come back later on and say, I never got your letter.
Correct. No, not exactly. So we have had times where we have sent it, depending upon the situation, we'll send it both first class and certified simultaneously. Generally, the first class will, if it's delivered, get there sooner. But the certified gives us proof of delivery,
right,
as well as we'll receive it back if the person does not pick it up. We've had it happen on occasion.
Okay.
But it is noted when I went through, within the policy. And then again, you have the policy attached after the presentation for your reference. Do you have any questions?
Tim, could you just touch on the process time for getting through the process and the improvements that we've been making around that?
Yeah, I mean, the process time, I'm going to say for a straightforward one that's going to the medical advisor, the process time is about 5 to 7 months from the date we receive the application. A lot of that time is tied back to getting adequate evidence and support from the member to file their claim and get it forward to the medical advisor. It's not, I'm trying to think. We probably have had, probably the least amount was probably it only took three pages of medical.
Yes.
information, it was sufficient based upon the individual's injury, it was safety.
And that's rare, that yeah. one or two reports would be enough.
We've had other situations where we've had two or three bins, those mail bins of information that they accumulated, and they're filing information all of the way up to the last minute. So we've seen that. Right now we're running about 65 open applications or in process at one time.
And I do want to comment that Tim and his staff have done a really great job in trying to reduce the turnaround time, because we know that our members are wanting resolution on this and that type of thing. And some of it it's not relying on CICERA doing something. A lot of the time has to do with getting the information from the members, and as Tim covered, it's really the onus is really on them to provide that information to us. I mean, we provide them information and counsel them, but ultimately it's up to the member to provide that information. And
yeah.
I see that we've made a number of great strides in really trying to reduce that time.
I think by starting to get more files electronically and so forth really will, you know, kind of start expediting the process more than receiving the paper and all the copying and sorting that has to take place, you know, as well as the working with the medical advisor has a certain period of time once he receives the information to turn around his findings, and then it's getting it scheduled for the next board meeting. And so there are, you know, you can artificially be extended by, if you miss by a day or two, it's not going to hit the board packet. You know, we're now running out another 30 days. But the team is in close communication with the individuals that have pending applications on a fairly regular basis. They are aware of what's going on. They know, you know, if the ball is kind of in their court on providing information. We actually go above, probably more above and beyond on assisting them through the process, like getting their work comp information for them, things like that. That is really their, you know, it falls within the members' responsibility to do that. We found it's easier to assist them through that process. Susan, when we go to hearings, does a lot of assistance, because the information for the Office of Administrative Hearings has to be filed electronically, and she steps in and assists them with that process. I mean, it's to our advantage that the members are treated right. We're here to help them through the process.
We go through a lot of counseling also when they first apply. Well, I have a new applicant right now that in 2 weeks I've had 4 appointments with him, because he just wants to bring more medical evidence in, has more questions about the process. And so he's been here 4 times in the last 2 weeks. And that's, you know, and that's what we do. So there's a lot on the, there's a lot of counseling on the front end of it.
Like I said, you know, percentage-wise, you know, for less than 50% of the applications that we send out overall come back as even being accepted. It's, you know, back into the, to go into process. But it's a lot of time spent with members explaining the process, explaining the definitions and what they want to do. And in a lot of cases, like Leilani mentioned, those meetings will turn into, I didn't know it was that hard. I don't think I'm going to do it. I'm just going to service retire.
Some don't want to wait. You know, they just want to retire, and especially the Tier 3 members, not so much the safety members, but when you explain the substantial gainful employment to people, sometimes people will say, I think I'm just going to take a regular service retirement. Other people are, it's, you know, yeah. They'll say, oh, I'm going to go through it.
I'm sorry if I missed this, but what does it matter? What is the difference to CICERA if someone has a service versus a non-service disability retirement? How does that impact CICERA?
The liability calculation will be different, because the benefit calculations are different, as well as the service-connected disability, say for a safety, also has 100% continuance to the beneficiary, which is different than, say, non-safety, where it goes to the 60% benefit.
Okay, so it's more than an IRS issue where it's taxable versus not taxable.
Right, yeah, there's financial issues on the liability and so forth. You know, as we've gone through some of them, where we see someone, you know, under the age of 40, and actually it's in our, the next agenda item where we're talking about the number of individuals with less than 10 years of service. I mean, you have individuals that could be potentially, say, in their 30s, retiring at 50% of their salary. And, you know, whether it's pre-tax or not, it doesn't impact MSA SACERA. It's to the individual, but now we have a liability of an individual that may have worked for or contributed to SACERA for, you know, we can say 13, 14, 15 years. Yeah. And now we could be paying this benefit out for, you know, say another 50 years till they're 85. And that benefit portion really wasn't fully funded by that individual, and so it's borne by the full system.
Another piece of that is not only are they only just having a few years of service, but also the age requirement. So for a normal retirement, it's higher, but if they're able to take a service-connected disability retirement, they don't have to be at that age. So that has a greater liability on the plan as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you take, you know, we look at a normal, say, you know, normal safety is the 3% at age 50 is probably the most regular service retirement we see. And it's like Gail mentioned, if they're, you know, 40 years old, it's 50% of their salary beginning at age 40. So system-wise, it can, the liability can be expensive.
Tim, something jumps out on that to me. One of the things you might expect is that somebody retiring on disability would have a shorter lifespan. Do we do any kind of study as to whether or not those who have retired on disability live less long, don't live as long as those who retire on a normal retirement?
I haven't had a chance to look at that. I mean, that is something that makes sense and that we should look at. Like I said, I just haven't had a chance, but we do have a number of individuals, you know, when I look at who, you know, our payroll report, we do have a high number of older individuals that were disability retirements, and, you know, they're over the age of 80.
It'd be a worthwhile thing to look at.
Yeah, again, and I'm trying to think, like, if I think about, like, the actuary, like a death report, you know, we're looking at deaths all the time and the type of retirement they were on and so forth. That's something we can add to it, but I really haven't seen, unless, like I said, it's someone that went out, I'm going to say, obviously, you know, like on a terminal illness, but then...
Well, it'd have to be a large group. Looking at the individual isn't fair and isn't productive, as a practical matter, but if on a large group basis, our disability retirees live as long as or longer than our normal service retirees, that at least tells us something about how disabled they are.
Yeah, I can take a look at that. I think that's a great idea. You know, but then when we look on the safety side, we can track if the member with the disability, you know, passes away, we're still have the beneficiary, or in a lot of cases, surviving spouse.
I'm just looking at
that depend. Yeah, we'll take a look at it.
Okay.
Yeah, great idea.
Sorry, Tim. On page 4, there's Exhibit 4, which is a graph that kind of peaks at 2014. Do you have a trend before that in terms of the numbers?
Oh, you're jumping. Okay, you're ahead of
me. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
Well, I think you're through the report.
We're pretty fast there, Will.
I'll answer it.
Will's a very fast reader.
Yeah.
I was actually reading off yours.
Oh, great. Throw me under the fire truck.
And then we have the mortality one. But we don't have, like, a...
No, we'll get to that.
I'm sorry.
There's a separate mortality schedule. Right. We don't have that.
I said it. Totally. Just,
Okay, if there are no other...
we get to item
11,
still on item 10, any questions of Tim?
Will?
Will?
All right, moving right along to item 11.